Welcome to our newest adventure for first responder wellness. No one fights alone. In-depth conversations about mental health and culture in the first responder space. We're joined by your co-hosts, Austin Pedersen and Brad Shepard.
And we're back, man. How's it going up there? Sounds like it's a little chaotic in Midway, Salt Lake Cityville.
Oh, dude, there was on the way to work today, there was a tanker that caught fire that was just in the middle of the highway. And so the world absolutely ended, and it took me like 2 hours to get here today. So it feels like I'm in California.
Well, it feels like I'm in Utah this week. Yeah. Yeah. Cause yeah. we got California boy on here who can relate. Yeah. So it was snowing here yesterday, March 28, March 27 here. It was snowing like crazy yesterday. Felt like Salt Lake City.
You know, you and you Oklahoma people, you get a little tiny dusting, and all of a sudden, it's, you know, same thing, the world ends.
Well, hey, I think that's a good segue to our guest. So our guest actually spent a lot of his growing up years in Oklahoma. Let me just introduce real quick Don Bradley so he can entertain some of that conversation before I read his bio and get started on some of this. Don, Oklahoma boy, now California transplant. How are you, man?
That's right. I'm fantastic. It's good to talk with you. I appreciate you allowing me on.
So Oklahoma, real quick, Oklahoma, how many years in Oklahoma you there?
I started out in Oregon before I knew what my wits. I opened my eyes and went, oh man, we need to get to Oklahoma. Product of divorce. We get taken out there. Oklahoma's where I'm from, because that's where I went to OU for school and got a degree in psychology. So probably if it was from 94, I think I came out of California in 94, but Oklahoma was from 5 until my mid 20s.
And you're right up the road from Austin's old stomping grounds is what I hear.
Sounds like it. Everything that used to be farmland is now, you know, apartment complexes.
Luxury condos.
Right. Apartment complexes that none of us can afford. By the way.
Yeah.
Well, let's run into this a little bit. Don is a licensed marriage and family counselor in Brentwood, California, former law enforcement officer. Don, it's a privilege to have you on. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, tell us a little bit about kind of how you, I know we bantered a little bit about your growing up, but tell us a little bit about how you got, maybe start with your law enforcement career. What was the draw and that, where did you end up? Give us a little bit of that journey.
Well, you know, I see this a lot in my practice now, but it came from this idea that I just wanted to help in some way. It was very sort of elementary. It didn't start out anything specific. You know, there wasn't a family member. It wasn't like, you know, I had a thing in my past that I was trying to sort of make better. I just wanted to help people, and I didn't want to die in a cubicle. So I basically said, well, what can I do where I'm helping people and there's action and all this kind of stuff? And of course I landed on firefighter, and in Santa Clara at the time they weren't having it. It was a demographic war. And so, you know, I went, well, okay, what can I do? And I ended up landing on the Sheriff's Department, Alameda County Sheriff's Department, went through the 106th Academy with a lot of good people, a lot of interesting people, some suspects now, and then went 2 years with Alameda County Sheriff's in the custodial setting, saw my first forced interaction, if you want to call it that. I'm trying to be kind in my description here. One of those sort of knocking the rose colored glasses off type of experiences where you're going, oh, this is real. This stuff happens. Realized I was going to spend too much time in the jail. So I said, you know, I'm going to go over to Hayward we got the opportunity. My friend and I went over to Hayward because we actually wanted to be out on the street. And after 9/11 happened, you're just kind of like, you want to do something. You want to get out there and start fighting crime, right? You develop this idea that it's going to look like something, it's going to be something. And then when you come into these situations, you're like, oh shit. Right. But I did that for about till 2004. I got injured. I got in a domestic violence thing where I swung a flashlight and broke the humerus bulb in my arm, and it cut up the nerves and stuff like that. ended up being out of work for about 6 months, went through that hell, trying to get recovered, came back, didn't get recovered, had another surgery, a lot of stuff. Now, when I say my law enforcement career, I enjoyed it. I loved it. It was always on patrol because I wanted to be the guy that pulled over the bad guy, tip of the spear type stuff, right? Terrorism liaison officer, crime scene technician, all the vehicle inspection stuff. I took whatever training I could get. The injury, however, had me, I didn't deal with that particular situation well. I mean, even though I had a degree in psychology, I didn't want to, you know, listen to people's problems all day. And so when I had that degree, it was just kind of hanging there for nothing. And then go through my own trials and tribulations. That first time off was pretty rough on me. Developed a pretty significant drinking problem, addiction to pain pills. It was almost comical at how cliche it was. And then you feel like you're abandoned because nobody comes to visit you. You're going through this sort of torturous alone hell. You know, I get back to work, you got the resentment, you still got the drinking problem, stuff like that. Things got pretty rough and got to the point where, you know, it basically disintegrated because, you know, you can't remember things. And it was a struggle. And then had another surgery and went through that whole process. And by the end, I shouldn't have been out on the street. And it was a good thing that I wasn't, honestly. But after I picked myself up from that, I realized that I did have a problem and I kind of needed to lean into it. And I go to, I went to John F. Kennedy University at the time, and the light bulb sort of went off and said, wait a minute, I had this degree in psychology. I had this traumatic things happen and I didn't utilize the resource. Not only did I not utilize the resource, but I didn't necessarily have the resources at the time. I did, but they weren't sort of thrust upon you. And so it wasn't like somebody said, hey, you got a problem, you need to get fixed. And so I put those two together and said, you know, maybe I can help somebody else not have to go through the things that I went through. And I say voila, but there's a lot more of a process in there to describe that.
Of course. How did you end up focusing on becoming a therapist from that? I mean, that's a really great transition. I see it unfolding and I see it unpacking there. Tell us a little bit more about how you arrived to that giving back, because it sounds like you're giving back now. You're helping.
Well, it was definitely difficult because you have to sort of admit that you were messed up and that you needed to sort of do this. And it really did sort of spring forth this whole new mission that I'm on, and I'll explain that later. But it sprung forth from the fact that I was like, I did not like the way this thing went down, and I need to make sure I know how hard it would be not only to go through that, but for somebody else to make that last little jump into doing something about it, right? Everybody's intellectually smart enough to do it, but there was that one thing I wanted to sort of help folks bridge that gap between getting right there, sort of intellectually knowing that there's something that they need to deal with, but making that little emotional jump, right? Because it's not easy to do. It wasn't easy for me to do. And so I just basically wanted to take the suffering that I went through, and I just needed to know that it was going to help somebody else, because I've always believed that, and I've always believed, it sounds like it's a little bit too dramatic, but I believe that if you have the capability, if something works, you got to hand it to somebody else. You got to be able, you know, if you have the capability, you have the responsibility.
I think that's so true. And I love the point that I feel as being, I want to draw out a point here that, you know, that's a really difficult physical decision to make when everything in you knows you need to do something, but you're preventing yourself from that last final opening the door, that last final taking a step off the ledge and leaping into doing good work. And it's, you know, I find that it's intrinsically holds a lot of fear There's a lot of reasons. There could be a lot of different reasons for, you know, individually why people do or don't do that. But what would be your take on that? Because I've found in my own personal journey in that it was fear based. It was 100 forms of fear based decision of
100% correct.
Need to do That's... the work and go do this. But and I wanted to. Everything in me said do this, but yet I just couldn't do that. And once I did. Amazing.
Well, and there's information scratching at the back of my head to get into the therapeutic stuff, because you're describing it perfectly and you're setting it up perfectly to remind folks that you can know the thing intellectually. You can say, yeah, on paper, you're right. I do need to go get help. But that's not the thing that's actually mashing on the gas pedal, because you're thinking, well, if I understand it intellectually, then I don't have to deal with it emotionally. It's like,
well, if we're there, Don, if we're there, let's just kick the door open. What is it? What's the message you want to convey?
Well, one of the main things I want to say is that there's not like an alarm that goes off that says that, hey, your husband's going to be an asshole in 3, 2, 1, you're right. Or your wife's going to be a bitch in 3, 2, 1. It's not like that. So there's not this alarm that goes off that tells you, oop, you better be careful, because the decisions you make here are going to affect the rest of your life when you call your wife the C word or whatever. Right. And it's like, wait a minute, hold on a second. Our brain it's about understanding that we have this sort of flicked switch, as it were. And that switch is affected by how you're stuffing these emotions in and telling yourself that you can't feel this stuff, you know, and that big old hurdle. And I'm talking about the trying to jump the hurdle, right? Everybody has the capability. They have the ability to fix what's wrong. But it's about getting past that first hurdle that allows you to do it, right? Because we that first little container that we get, whether we have good parents, bad parents, no parents, love and support, abuse and neglect, it shapes how big that container is going to be and how often we're able to pour it out. And if like me, I grew up in Oklahoma, it was rub some dirt on it, you pussy, and stuff like that. And then coming out of California, becoming a police officer, and it's sort of drilled in that not only is it embarrassing and weak to be able to show emotions, but you also going to these terrible situations, the worst situations for people that you can possibly imagine, for them, the worst thing in their life. And then having to just be, I'm terribly sorry for your loss, you know, like that, because you have to, right? That's the color in the painting, and that's a painting you don't want to see, right? So you just stuff this stuff down into the container. Eventually that container blows, and I'm telling you, deal with it now, because you're not only you're hurting your life now, but you're hurting your future life too.
And I want to talk a little bit, because you brought up like the childhood portion, like, and you know what we've seen a lot in our space is that, you know, a lot of the behaviors, a lot of the way we deal with stressful situations is the same way that we dealt with them as a child, right? And so, you know, the question I have for you is as you're going through with people that, you know, their cup has become full with these traumatic incidents and all of that stuff, are you seeing that those that were incapable of dealing with stress as a child, that transfers into their adulthood as well? And those that were able to deal with stress, deal with it better as an adult?
It does have a lot to do with those early experiences, of course. I mean, if you experience these high levels of anger and fear and things like that, the very first language we learn isn't any particular dialect. It's body language, right? Because when you're a baby and you're looking at mom and mom's stress and you're basically going, ooh, and you're inside your body, you're going, what the fuck is going on right now? You're absorbing that. And you're also absorbing the overbearing parents and the abandonment and neglect and stuff like that. And it's not like we sit there and go, yeah, boy, that makes sense. I should really see how that's going to affect the future. we're looking at, we absorb that stuff and it just sort of comes out in how we end up being able to either be or not be resilient. And I've just deal with the least resilient people you can, because it's about that. It's about whether you can.
Yeah. Well, and also their belief is that they can't because they haven't been able to deal with it their whole life.
Right? Sure. Like, and I can explain that too. That's the part where that I try to get people to understand is that it'll make sense to you and you'll intellectually get it. Some of the smartest people, I deal with some of the most clever people in the business. And it's not about the intellectual cleverness. And I'll explain what I'm talking about. I'm sure you guys have both been to like a county fair, right? Of course.
Oh, yeah. Right?
What do you think of? You think of Ferris wheels, cotton candy, funnel cakes, corn dogs, games, all that kind of stuff, right? In fact, you take a big deep breath, you can practically smell it, right? Well, if you remember those games in the middle where, you know, it looked like just trailers that pop and pop up the things. It had the ones with the horses where they chased each other, right? Okay, so remember going back to the fact that doesn't matter who you are on this planet, doesn't matter where you're from. If you're standing on this grain of sand that's hurtling through space right now, this applies to you, okay? And so everybody has four horses that pulls their life, right? And like I said, this is precedes all of your stuff. And so going back and sort of recognizing this and realizing the spots that were kind of hurting is there's the physical horse. It's like your physical identity, how important it is to you, whether you're big, you're small, you're a gym bro, you're sick all the time. But you land on a spectrum. Everybody lands on that spectrum. Then there's the intellectual horse. That's the one that's, you know, book smart versus street smart, right? Or somewhere in between. We fall somewhere on that spectrum. Then there's a social horse, loner, cool kid in the group, somewhere on that spectrum. And then there's the emotional horse. I put the spiritual in there too, but the emotional, and you land somewhere on that spectrum, right? Well, you think about somebody like me, this is where you kind of have to throw yourself on the sword. The way I was taught was that you didn't deal with emotions. You never, if you cried, somebody would look at you or shame you or do whatever. And it's like, okay. So we don't do that. Okay, got it. Right. And then you learn these things and you develop this sort of like, oh, that's the way I'm going to be. And you get up to the spot where it just locks in. But the simple fact is, it doesn't mean that it wasn't a foundational part of my life, because that last horse, right, those four horses about to get ready to take off and you're born and bang, the gun goes off and you try to figure out who you are physically, intellectually, socially, and emotionally. Right? For myself, physically meant, you know, being tough and playing football and doing all that kind of stuff, right? Intellectually meant being smart, okay? Socially mean being popular, right? Nobody wanted to be the emotional person, right? Because that was the albatross hanging around your neck, right? But everybody's got that thing that they're trying to pull, right? Well, if I'm told my whole entire life that you're not allowed to feel feelings, and then you get really professional at it by being a cop and or anybody in the military, stuff like that, and you're going, no, turn it off. Then that horse goes back behind the gate, they weld that thing shut, and you have to deal with everything, everywhere else, right? Things get difficult. These are your coping mechanisms. What are you going to do? I'm going to work overtime, or I'm going to fight somebody, or I'm going to go to the gym. Oh, you know what? I'm good at intellectualization, making it intellectual. Yeah, I can understand it. So that means I'm better at it, right? Socially, what do? Choir practice. We go and we hang out with our friends. We're telling them, you know, this terrible story. We're boiling on the inside at this horrible thing we just saw. And then we go and say, yeah, it was pretty bad, huh? And then when we see it doesn't affect them, we shame ourselves.
Or you turn it into dark humor.
Yeah, well, that's exactly right. I mean, some of the darkest.
Yeah,
I may say a couple things here and there that's going to sound really dark, but it's how it boils in you, right? Because we can't judge our insides by somebody else's outsides, especially if we've just got this. Yeah, I'm fine. Nothing's bothering me, right?
I think before we kind of unpack, your version of how to how to heal or bring healing to this. I think we ought to spend some time a little bit talking about the nuances of this, because I love where you're going with this four horse piece. In within first responder culture, let me just say, the new buzzword is emotional intelligence. You know, and everybody thinks they know what emotional intelligence means or the standards within emotional intelligence. And arguably, I'd say on some level or on one plane, cops and first responders, veterans, they know they're emotionally intelligent enough to actually push down or negate anything emotional. You've been taught this. If it's a negative emotion, suppress it, fight it back. You've been trained. And I'm not saying that's emotional intelligence, but some people would understand that. On another plane, it's understanding your own and other people's emotions as well. But even on the spiritual aspect, you lumped in emotional and spiritual together in your four horsemen. On a spiritual platform, you know, there's you're taught, you know, God first, family second, work third. That is not at all how it's lived out. That's not even remotely close how it's lived out. So framing the spiritual aspect within emotional, I see where you're going with this, because even the spiritual aspect of, how could a higher power do this? How could God allow this to happen? Now you start having this inner conflict of, well, I'm not sure what I believe, or maybe I'm not going to believe anything, or I'm just going to be mad. My personal, I'm just going to be angry at that, and I'm not going to unpack that. I don't know how to unpack it, so I'm just going to walk away from it. So I think there's a lot of depth to this concept of these four horses that maybe we could spend a little bit of time unpacking on. Why do you think cops, firefighters, veterans really walk away from this emotional side, this emotional piece?
They think that the consequences are going to be irreversible, and they'll be, I mean, it crushes the very foundation of this strength that they think they have to hold up. And I get it. It makes total sense. You have to be, and there's times when you're seeing a dead child that it doesn't have to look anything like your own, but the fact that you're sitting there having to do to not be affected by
a dead child at the hands of a shipment.
Right, exactly. And so, and then having to sort of maintain this, stay within this line type of deal, where you get really good at doing, not just in the job, but also outside of the job, right? And it boils over and boils over. And it's like, no, that's not how you deal with it. That's how you ignore it.
Right.
And so, but you can't ignore it, because first responders, military folks, they prepare their whole entire lives for the fight that comes from the outside in. They don't spend any time for the one that comes from the inside out. And when it does, it melts them.
Right.
Right. And so I'm saying it's not a weakness. It's a pillar that you got to make sure that it's a muscle you got to make sure that you exercise, because if you don't, it ain't going to be there when you put weight on it.
And I think describing that, what that looks like is you, because I found myself there, I've talked to many people there, they'll sit down and say, what the fuck is going on with me? Like, I don't understand what's happening with me right now, you know?
Well, that's, so let me, we're going back to the four horses, right? I told you that we use these three: physical, intellectual, social, as the coping mechanisms. And when we work out or fight or do whatever and it doesn't work, we're like, what the hell? When it intellectually, the intellectual horse will sit there and bully the emotional horse. I got this. If I understand this, because that's what's so frustrating, is intellectually I get it. Why don't I feel better emotionally? It's like, okay, well, that's because you're doing it. This one's trying to basically keep that thing from opening, right? And socially, like I said, we go out, we drink to excess, we become addicts because we're socially trying to deal with the thing that container being too full, right?
All the dopamine things, right? Could be gambling, social media, sex,
anything to make yourself feel better, right? Drinking. The impulsive behavior, no question. I got caught up in that, and that stuff will eat you alive, right? But we don't realize in the path of this little this one that we haven't let out, the emotional one, we've created this massive amount of Mount Everest pile of shit that ain't going away. It was never going away. You were never, it's just waiting for its turn, right? Well, the gate, something finally happens. The wind blows the wrong direction or whatever. Container gets too full. That little baby comes out, looks at that big pile of shit and goes, I'm not dealing with this. I can't do that. When these guys get really super desperate, they get desperate because they're being forced to do something they've been told their whole entire life that they're not allowed to do. And then if they do, that means their life is over. So they end up taking their lives. I'm like, and it absolutely crushes my heart. Every time I see that, I'm like, man, I wish they would have called me. Please call me if you're having that feeling. Because it's just about understanding, right? And I tell people there's three things that have to happen in order for change to occur. By the way, there's a package on the way to you with all of those goods I told you about.
Love it.
There's three things that have to happen. They're going to sound super obvious. And I like, this is part where I'm kind of embarrassed at how obvious they are. But I implore you to kind of just wait a second. Let's figure this out. And you'll see how obvious they aren't. You got to acknowledge that something's going on. If you've been depressed for 20 years, it's not who you are. You've been depressed for 20 years. Acknowledge it, right? Number two, you have to accept the level to which that thing is negatively affecting your life, right? I only drink a little bit. Yeah, everybody else thinks you're a fucking alcoholic. But until it changes in you, it ain't going to change.
I don't drink as much as Austin. So as long as we've given ourselves that, you know.
Okay, can you put the meter up in the background so that I know if you guys pass each other on the list?
Yeah, I am the best. Yeah. That's what I heard right there.
Yeah. You're number one. You're number one.
Yep, exactly.
So the third one, and this is the crux of this whole mission that I'm talking about, right? The thing that I want everybody to join because your life depends on it. That's why I want you to join this mission. So I kind of metaphorically tricking you, right? And that is that you've got to give yourself permission to act on your own behalf. It is harder than it sounds. And when I talk about permission, I'm talking about this little guy right here. When he finally has to come out, you got to go, he's going to be afraid. Okay. Yep. You're afraid. Got it. He's going to need some help. Okay, great. There are other three horses that are thoroughbreds. They're like, they're bullies. They don't want that thing to come out. We've been handling this. We got this. We can handle things when they come up. How dare you come out? You should be ashamed of yourself, right? They're just chiming in. And that little wobbly leg, stilt-legged, doe-eyed baby that comes out, you got to give that sucker permission to be afraid and to ask for help. And to deal with each one of these things. Because have you ever seen anybody jump to the top of Mount Everest?
No.
No?
Not happening.
Okay, no. Yeah. Small steps and a guide, right? It's okay. You don't do it by yourself. And that's a tough thing for those other three horses to admit, to say, yeah, I do need help. Physically, I need to admit that I need this help. Intellectually, I need to do it, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I love where you're going with this. I think it's that simple, yet it's that difficult.
Well, but think about, remember what I said about, so this is our survival brain. This is our big brain, right? The time when this thing turns on, this is the mainframe. This is where all the good information is, right? And the problem is when we're dealing with this emotional stuff, it goes click. And remember what I said, this thing doesn't contemplate, ruminate, investigate. It doesn't do any of that stuff. It just reacts. And we get the reaction from going from way back in the very beginning, you know, or the stuff that that's trained into us. And that's why this is the new mission, is you gotta train this part of your brain so that when you know, it becomes necessary to put weight on it, there'll actually be something there to hold it up. Right. And it's and understanding that it's about your humanity. It's got nothing to do with you being weak or anything like that. It's the foundation of who you are. And so for you to ignore it, deny it, or say it's weakness, it's like, what? You kidding me? If you have a four-legged table, all your physical is good, your intellectual is good, your social is good, emotional, and you think, oh well, you know, that's weakness. Well, when you go to put weight on it, that table's going to fall.
Well, I think this is the part where I was going to kind of follow up with this emotional intelligence piece, which is actually being self-aware enough to know that that's a pillar, as you call it. This is a pillar that has to be given its due time and attention, or you're not going to be well. The totality of who you are as a human is not going to be well or healthy. And that's the true, what I believe, that's the true essence of being emotionally intelligent, saying, hey, something's off with me. But to date, we've been trained even to ignore that. We've been trained to say, oh, that's just your emotion. Don't worry about that. You can think through this, or you can physically go through, you know, work yourself through this, or you can socialize yourself out through this. So yeah, I love the concept.
Well, that intellectual horse will do everything it can possibly do to try to make sure that emotional horse does come out. Because if they're telling themselves, if I understand it intellectually, then emotionally I'll be okay. It's like, well, and then when they get there and they come to that, then they get to that understanding and go, well, why don't I feel better? It's like, well, because you're not dealing with it emotionally. It takes vulnerability, something that you have to be willing. You have to give yourself permission to give yourself. I know it's tough, man. It's I'll be the first one to tell you it's tough.
So what do you think? Yeah, I got to do it. But it's one of those things. I mean, we have this conversation all the time, is how do you get somebody who has not been vulnerable for 35, 40 years to break that wall? Is it desperation? Like it's the ultimate question.
Well, desperation, it just so happens that I seem to specialize in desperation, because a lot of the folks that I talk with are very, you know, combat vets and stuff like that. And so when grizzled veterans and stuff like, and what it comes down to is first of all, you have to know what you're talking about. I don't think I could have the position that I have without having had the experience I have, and sort of that pedigree's got, I got to kind of lead with the pedigree a little bit, and being able to create a spot where the person goes, oh, okay, you do get it. You do understand. Cause that's the biggest thing, is getting somebody to actually, to let them know that you understand them. And that right there just kind of shifts that weight over and says, hey, I'll let you put a shoulder into this weight a little bit as I get a little bit more comfortable to let some of this stuff out. And it's a process. It's a tough process. But at the very first thing is just letting that person know that you're listening to them. You hear what they're actually saying. You understand the weight of the thing that they're holding on to. And then just kind of shaping that into smaller pieces that they can sort of, that they're basically sloughing off themselves, doing our ABCs, right? A is the event, whatever the event is chronologically. B is the oh shit moment. And C is the either the value statement or the unanswered question. Why would God do this, right? Can't tell you how many times I saw things where I'm like, God doesn't exist. There's no way he can exist. With this, there's no way that. And so having to come back into my relationship with him, it was very challenging, but I understand a lot better. And it's because I allowed myself to be vulnerable and deal with that stuff and do it one step at a time. That's what I'm telling. That's my message, is just about this process of sort of getting started. I don't know what your process is going to be. I deal with the triage and the terribleness and the come down off that ledge. That's emotionally speaking, those are my folks. I deal with highly volatile people. And it's because they've allowed this container to get so full that when they let it out, it's chaos, right? Not only is the weight getting heavier, but the muscles are getting weaker. And it feels like it's going to crush them.
The No One Fights Alone podcast is excited to announce the launch of our new merchandise line. Now you can show your support for our mission by purchasing one of our hats, shirts, or hoodies. Our merchandise not only represents our brand and message, but also supports a great cause. A portion of all proceeds will go towards helping individuals and families affected by mental health. Wearing our merchandise not only spreads awareness for our podcast, but also serves as a reminder that no one has to fight alone. Join us in showing your support and spreading the message of hope and community by purchasing one of our No One Fights Alone items today from our website, nofapodcast.com, nofapodcast.com.
So we're talking about some really heavy, difficult things. And then we, because I was here, I remember thinking, what in the fuck are you talking about giving yourself grace and permission? When you're in the trenches of this funk, you know, to put it maybe a light version, this horrible position that you're in of darkness and not seeing out, and all you see is scourge of humanity, and somebody comes up and says, you know, give yourself permission, give yourself grace. I identify with the fact that it's I don't even know what you're talking about. Like, what? And so oftentimes I personally, and I'd love to hear your version of this, I personally just sit down and say, tell me your story, which is, I believe, Don, I believe I'm actually echoing and setting an example of grace and permission and just listening and giving them that opportunity to, and demonstrating to them, this is how you can do this inwardly, inside yourself. Is that similar to what you're talking about?
Yes. And I think a lot of it is sort of, I'm trying to emphasize this idea of this inside out process, meaning that if you try to tell somebody something and then you see that they cringe from your experience, you're not going to tell them that stuff anymore. Right. And so the idea, the grace is that feeling of that shame or guilt whenever you're telling something that because you're trying to look through other people's eyes. And the simple fact is there, you know, do we have the ability to read other people's minds? No, of course not. And so we feel that sense of shame as it comes back to us without it having a basis in reality.
Absolutely. Cause you tell a story in a family setting and you know immediately if you've gone over the edge. I mean, I remember being everybody wanted to hear stories. Well, what kind of story do you want? Do you want a funny story? Do you want a not funny story? Do you want a guilt story? Do you want an ugly story? Do you want death? I mean, what do you tell me what you want? I got them all. And you know, you tell a story or two and before too long, everybody's like, okay, that's too much. You know, you've gone too far and you've only
scratched the surface,
knocked off the surface. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yep.
And so then in saying that, you're being led to believe, well, okay, I can't talk about this.
Well, okay, you're doing this thing. You make this thing and tell this story. And maybe in your mind, you're thinking, oh, okay, I get to maybe let a little bit of this out. But then when you do, you're like, ooh, that's too much. You're like, I was vulnerable right there. And you just rejected the shit out of me.
No, I completely, yes, I completely see and completely get. So kind of reiterating your acknowledgement of something's wrong, accepting the fact that, hey, you've got some negative impacts, and I'm overviewing this a little bit, and correct me if I'm wrong, if I'm missing it, but, and then three is giving yourself this permission. Now what? Now you've given yourself permission. Now what?
So when I talk with the people that I talk with, I try to get them to do their ABCs, and A is the that chronological event. B is the oh shit moment. And C is that, like I said before, that, you know, the value statement or the unanswered question, right? Why would God do this? And ABCs, I find that's, you know, it kind of gives you this, let you know that they go through this. They're basically their list of traumas. And this can go all the way back to the very beginning. But A is the event, right? The car crash, this when it was a child, the this, whatever that thing is that, right? And then there's the oh shit moment. And the reason I call it the oh shit moment is because it's that thing where you realize that this was going to be an event that you're going to remember. Like what? And I'll give you an example of a situation that somebody that said that it was okay for me to talk about, but I'm not going to be specific. Pulled somebody over on the freeway, was giving them a ticket. They go to write the ticket, comes back to the car, is writing the ticket, looks up in the rearview mirror because they hear something and realize that in the next tenth of a second, they're about to get obliterated by a car, right? Because the car just smashed them, tore them up. They ended up, you know, getting badly hurt, going through all this rehab, workman's comp, all this kind of stuff, come back and they're having a hard time sort of re-engaging, right? They can't, they're, and so the oh shit moment was literally looking up into the rearview mirror and that inner protective structure he thought was going to be there forever was about to be shattered and he couldn't do anything about it. Right. It's this idea that we built this idea that we're going to be okay. We're going to live a long life. We're not going to get hurt. We're going to do all this kind of, we have all these expectations. And then when something happens that busts those expectations, we're like, oh shit, what do we do now? Right. That thing where, you know, that person thought that they were going to be good and safe. And at the very least, even if they died, they'd have a chance to do something. And in that split second, he knew he couldn't do anything about it. And it was, and that could get caused that internal structure to bust whenever the external structure busted too. Right. And so going through that emotional process, it was, you got to kind of let somebody know, hey, did you know that that's what happened whenever you, you know, that you were, you had this expectation, and what were your expectations? Well, I expected that I was going to go home at night, that I wasn't going to get hurt and these things. And it kind of shatters that a little bit. And so when you have that oh shit moment where you're like, oh crap, I might die, right?
Yep.
You have the I might die. And then there's the emotional reaction to the I might die, right? Well, come to find out, this wasn't true. This didn't happen, but this still did. Right? That grenade went off, right? And so you got to go back in and reclaim your life because your expectations were that, because you're playing on the house's money. If you go, you have something where you think you're going to die, you got to emotionally go back in there and say, okay, because this incident happened, now what expectations do I have in my life? Well, I'm not bulletproof anymore, right? That's what I thought before. And then this thing happened and it kind of went, shattered everything. It's like, okay, yeah, that's normally what happens to a human being. Even though you thought you were going to be this big, tough, I'm always going to be there. Guess what? Happens to you too. Well, you gotta that whole giving permission thing, you gotta give yourself permission to have a space where you're allowed to be bothered by this stuff. Like it, because where else in your brain is this stuff supposed to go? And if it goes in, if every other place in his brain goes to a place where it's not accepted, then yeah, you're gonna develop physical symptoms. You're gonna develop the want to turn that emotion off and drink yourself into a stupor. Of course you're going to want to do that. And that's because you just want to turn it off.
I can't tell you how many times I've seen an old crusty hand that you just described. His grenade went off. He became, he went through, I don't know how many life or death situations, or went through his ABCs and has had multitude of oh shit moments. Try to communicate to a younger officer or firefighter, said, hey, this is going to be hard. You need to prepare for it. But he himself or she herself won't give themselves that permission to just heal and acknowledge that damage.
That's 100% fair and true. Yes, that's exactly right. It's gotta go through your permission. You've gotta say, I want to feel better. I want to be whatever that thing is after. But if you're sitting there and you go, well, I've been the helper all my life, that means that I'm the one that helps, not the other way around. Right? I can't, that'd be a violation of everything that I was, is to ask for help. It's like, well, wait a minute, hold on a second. It's the whole, you know, mask on the airplane deal where you got to put it on yourself first.
Well, to circle back to the point you're making, which is your 1, 2, 3, which is the example that I just used, they've accomplished one. They are internally acknowledging something happened in their life. And they're two, they've somewhat accepted it, because they're trying to communicate to somebody else, says, hey, this, this could potentially happen, or it will will happen to you. But that step three, again, gets everybody. That step three, which is giving yourself permission to go see a Don, or go to a Chateau, or go see a somebody. I mean, that's the hard part. That's the hard step.
Again. Well, the acknowledging part, the very first step, that's the intellectual horse saying, I get it. I know that there's something going on. But the third step is the permission step. So letting that little baby out and go, ooh, I'm scared. I don't like this. And I'm not supposed to be scared. You know, it's that fight back and forth between what your expectations are and how they're, because originally, like I said, you set up these expectations that you're never going to need help. And all this structure. And then when you start stepping into that structure, you're like, oh, this shame and guilt and all this kind of, and you got to acknowledge the fact that that's going to happen. You got to accept the fact that it's going to happen.
Well, Don, this has been a great conversation. So if we kind of wrap this up, I'd love to spend all day with you here, but if there were, you know, one, two, or maybe three things, like the what's next, let's say, a person says, yes, I'm going to give myself permission. What's next? What advice would you give to our listeners of just the culminizing this entire conversation into a couple, two or three valuable points of messaging for you? What would you have for them?
I would definitely remember the whole big brain, little brain thing, just because what you're trying to let yourself know is that the only job whenever your survival brain is on is to turn it off. It's not to try to fix your life or reconcile your relationship or do anything like that. It's to basically just turn it off, right? The other thing I would let folks know is that emotions will go out the open door, not the correct door. And so make sure that when you're feeling something, communication is like playing catch with a baseball. There's the way it's thrown and the way it's caught. And so you got to understand that sometimes you catch something because you wanted to catch it that way, right? Or you didn't put your glove up and you wanted it to hit yourself in the face so you could react based on what you thought they were throwing at. And it's like, just give yourself a little grace and give yourself that permission, like I said, to interpret it some other way other than the way that's going to hurt you.
I love that one right
yeah,
there.
Yeah, that's a great one.
That is, yeah, I'm going to steal that one from you if you're
it's
okay.
All yours. Yeah. I didn't copyright it, so.
Well, Don, great conversation. If some of the listeners wanted to connect with you, how would they get a hold of you, Don?
Well, they probably want to go to therapy with Don, D-O-N-N, at Gmail. They can get a hold of me that way, or they can go onto the Psychology Today website and find my profile. I'm out of Brentwood. I'm pretty low key on the whole advertising thing because the first responders and folks that I typically deal with, they don't, I'm not the patches on the sleeves, tell me about your mother type. So I'm the guy that is going to be a little bit more real. And so I'm not trying to advertise out there a lot of stuff, but I will definitely make myself available to whoever.
You know, the good ones, talk to me. The good ones are always hard to find. So, man, I appreciate you coming on. I appreciate you coming on, Don. Thank you so much for this conversation. It's been awesome.
Thanks for talking with me, fellas. I appreciate it.
Chateau Health and Wellness is a 16-bed treatment facility nestled in the foothills of the Wasatch Mountains in Midway, Utah. Chateau's First Responder Resiliency Program is designed to treat the unique challenges and issues that first responders encounter in the course of their careers. Chateau's comprehensive and highly individualized approach to treatment addresses more than just the presenting issues. It addresses the why. Each of their seasoned, trauma-trained, and culturally competent therapists utilize evidence-based, specialized therapies to treat trauma at its core and enable clients to begin the healing process while developing a resilient and healthy relationship with stress. Chateau Health and Wellness is trusted by departments and agencies from around the country to treat responders and veterans. In fact, it is one of only a handful of facilities nationwide that is vetted and approved to treat members of the Fraternal Order of Police. For more information or to speak to a representative, go to chateaurecovery.com or call 888-507-5031.